These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. These lectures are titled Rome and the Barbarians, Part 3. Lecture 25, Romanization of the Provinces.
In this lecture, I plan to look at the question of Romanization of the various frontier provinces that have come under control of the Roman emperors. And this is one of three lectures that deals with the social and economic transformation of the frontier provinces and also the barbarians on the other side of those frontiers. And it brings us back to one of the first themes of which I spoke in the initial lecture, and that is the ability of the Romans to adapt existing institutions and to bring in their own conceptions of citizenship, political organization, and incorporate these former foes into the Roman system. It also raises important questions about the nature of the Roman army. As I mentioned in earlier lectures, this was a professional imperial army, in some ways a society unto itself, and certainly the best organized, largest, and one of the best paid institutions in the entire Roman Empire. And that, in turn, links us into wider questions of Roman economic and social success in the High Empire. Why was the Roman Empire such a stable organization for almost three centuries? How did those institutions play in assimilating these former barbarians, now provincials? And what was the impact beyond the imperial frontiers that affected the various barbarian peoples to the north, south, and east, who in various ways became linked to the remarkable success of the Roman Empire? Well, in this lecture, we're going to concentrate on an issue that is still quite controversial among historians, that is the patterns and nature of Romanization. And given the nature of this course, where we're stressing the interaction between Romans and barbarians, we're going to concentrate on the frontier provinces. And it's important to note at this point and to remember that the Roman Empire was a vast area, well over a million square miles at the time of Trajan's death. And you have to calculate also the Mediterranean shores, the Mediterranean Sea, the Black Sea, all of these bodies of water, which were highways to the Roman economic system. And so there's a whole process of Romanization going on in the provinces that are quote-unquote civilized or civilian. Most of these provinces were under senatorial governors. There were no military forces stationed there. This would represent largely the Mediterranean core of the empire. Italy, Greece, much of Spain at this point would be so classified. Very wealthy and important islands such as Sicily. Egypt, a very civilized region, a good deal of Syria and what is today Lebanon called Phoenicia. These were areas where there were urban civilization, Mediterranean patterns of farming, and the process of Romanization in there was different in many ways from the frontier provinces, and one of the large differences was the overwhelming presence of the Roman army in the frontiers. And the impact of the army on the frontier. So it's important to stress that this lecture is looking at those frontier zones. And part of it is not just the nature of this course that we're dealing with Rome and interaction with barbarians, but also an important historical theme that has to be kept in mind at this point. And that is the increasing importance of these frontier zones. As the Roman imperial government invests ever much more money, military force, administration, so that by 300 AD, the frontier zones, while they represent certainly a minority of the population of the Roman world, maybe 20-25%, compared to that Mediterranean core, the original base of the empire, they are overwhelmingly important from a political, military, and even fiscal standpoint. And that is an important shift that goes on in the Roman Empire that is very important to remember when we turn to the later empire and the breakup of Roman power. Well, the Roman imperial army played a decisive role in these frontier provinces. The legionary bases, of which I have spoken in various lectures, they were more than just military strong points for launching expeditions against the barbarian foe. They became very quickly societies and cities of their own. They were big centers of consuming. The Roman army needed to be supplied, and soldiers who are professional soldiers are not going to spend time farming and getting engaged in crafts. They have to be supplied. One of the points I made in several lectures is that the Roman frontiers, the limes, that limit between the barbarian lands and Rome, came to rest in areas along lines of communication where the army could be very easily supplied. This is why Hadrian's Wall was built where it was. This is why the Rhine and the Danube became those frontiers, because they were essentially highways. The rivers provided easy trade routes. You could supply the army very readily that way. It explains the Euphrates. It explains the system of highways and military posts in North Africa and Syria, where the Roman army is kept well back from the desert rim. They're in the zone where they have access to water. They're not going to be posted right on the desert rim. We have some very good studies now based on archaeology in northern Europe of what the army's economic and social impact could be. Think for a moment of the Julio-Claudian army in the Rhineland in the first century of the empire. Well over 100,000 soldiers were originally stationed along the Rhine after the Varian disaster. You could make all sorts of calculations. These men would annually need something on the order of 7.5 million modii of wheat, and this is the Roman measurement of grains, and 48 modii are considered to be necessary as the annual adult male minimum. That's somewhere on the order of 50 or 60,000 tons of wheat that would have to be brought in or produced in the area. The Roman army also issued very generous rations in meat, wine, olive oil, other types of commodities such as garum, which is it's a fish sauce used to spice up your food, and it's made from the rotten guts of fish in Spain. It sounds hideous, but apparently it was the rage in the empire, and it made fortunes in Gades, today Cadiz in Spain. All of this would have to be shipped into the Rhineland. And contrary to popular opinion, where everyone thinks the Romans essentially ate wheat and a vegetarian diet, the Roman army ate a great deal of meat, especially pork, but in time, beef. They learned to consume beef, especially in northern Europe, and this had major economic consequences. For instance, the forces on the Rhine were being supplied in the first century AD, in the Julio-Claudian age, largely from a production in northern Italy, especially the city of Milan, just above the Po Valley. The trade routes over the Alpine passes linked northern Italy to the Rhineland. Those routes would become all important in the Roman period and persist as the main lines of communications between Italy and northern Europe well to this day. It becomes the great axis of Rome to London, in effect. You can trace how the fact that you have 100,000 Roman soldiers added to them dependents, merchants settling in the Conobi, the districts, the communities to supply the army, all demand Roman products. Wine becomes an item that's consumed now by the Gauls. One of the best examples of how the process takes place is in the Roman city of Treviri, today Trier, in the Mosel Valley in western Germany. The Mosel flows into the Rhine, and the Mosel is the farthest point north today where wine can be produced. You grow it in this remarkable slate valley, which retains the heat even during winter, and it is still a region where the wines are prized. And Trier was the Celtic capital of this area, named after the Treviri. It's the modern German city of Trier. It changes from an oppidum into a city in the first century AD. And that's because the city became one of the main centers for supplying the Roman army on the Rhine. Wine production begins, certainly by the middle of the first century AD, and becomes extremely important in the second, third century AD and ever after. The city begins to acquire impressive Roman buildings as money is made in the supplying of the army. The pottery production that was originally centered in Italy, the so-called Aretine pottery, which is produced in central Italy, had been brought up in the Julio-Claudian age. By the end of the first century, early second century AD, there are shops being opened up in southern Gaul and Narbonensis because it's easier to supply the armies. By the end of the second, early third century AD, the shops of glass, pottery, ceramics, all of that has moved to the vicinity of Trier and is even closer to the army. So in supplying the army, you change the whole pattern of manufacturing and distribution of goods as these provincial zones are increasingly brought under Roman control and integrated into the economic basis for supplying this huge army. So the effect in Gaul is very dramatic. Eastern Gaul, the Rhine and the cities along the eastern routes of Gaul emerge as major centers by the middle of the 1st century A.D. And as you go into the 2nd century A.D., villa farming, Roman methods of agriculture and management take off. And you can see the Gallic notables adopting various Roman tastes and patterns of social behavior. Even those regions in Gaul not directly tied to the equipping and supplying of the army are profoundly changed. This can be traced as you look at oppida, that is Gallic hill forts, in the regions of Gaul which were not directly linked to the supply of army. The Romans put in road systems, canals. The best analysis now of the Roman economy shows that the Romans moved goods by sea, by river transport, and by road, approximately in the same proportions as would be the case in 18th century Europe on the eve of the Industrial Revolution. I mean, their ability to move and distribute goods would be as good as anything you had in early modern pre-industrial Europe. And this is really an important fact to keep in mind, because these movements of goods also were accompanied by movements of attitudes, language, and identity that followed in the wake of this. You see in Gaul, for instance, cities changing. In some instances, cities took the pattern of Treviri. Such a city would be now modern Paris, Roman Lutetia, a modest town of a really minor Celtic tribe, which gets all sorts of advantages by being on the Roman trade routes, ultimately put in by the Roman army, although the city itself is not directly tied to the army. And as a result, people make money, classes emerge that can put up arenas, Roman-style buildings. In other instances, you have cases where the Celts were residing in a hill fort, such as Bibracte, which is the site of one of Julius Caesar's battles. It's on a mountaintop. It's also the location of the medieval city. And once the Romans put highways through the plains, which ultimately link the army on the Rhine, but they're running through these districts, people just leave the hill forts and move down to the plains where the roads intersect. And so Celtic Bibracte is, in effect, supplanted by Roman Autun, Augusto Dunum, which is the Latin name for it. That is, there's no point in being on the hill forts. There's now peace and security, and all the action is down in the plains. And through the whole of the Roman world, in the frontier zones, you can tell the difference between a pre- and a post-Roman site just on where the cities are located. If they're up on fortified positions, that's pre-Roman or post-Roman. If they're down in the plains, you're in a Roman situation. And so Gaul is dramatically transformed by just the fact that there is now this huge Roman military establishment protecting the frontier, and that results in major changes in Gallic society where the population is increasingly being Romanized. The same pattern can be shown in Britain, where the army was smaller, somewhere on the order of 45,000 to 50,000 men in the Julio-Claudian age, but you're dealing with a smaller population, and its impact in some ways was even more profound than it was in Gaul, because the Roman military presence was so important in transforming that northwestern corner of the Roman world. And the patterns can be traced through the Balkans. They can be traced in Dacia, in eastern Turkey, where the great Lime system was put in by the Flavians, and even to some extent along the desert frontiers of Syria and North Africa. The moving in of Roman forces profoundly changed local economies and the societies used to sustain that. With the advent of that Roman military presence and the developing Roman-style cities, you have to keep in mind that most of the cities that were not right on the frontier, the elites in those areas were largely not Roman. They were very often locals, notables. Some of them had acquired Roman citizenship through military service or some kind of particular loyalty to Rome. They would take on Roman names. In Gaul, the number of men with Julii and Claudii suggest they had all served in the auxiliary army, hadn't gotten citizenship either under Augustus or the Emperor Claudius. They learned their Latin through contacts with Roman administrators and soldiers, and they took over the job of Romanizing their cities behind the frontier. And again, Gaul gives us a very good example. This is seen in the construction of amphitheaters. The Gauls find that Roman taste of blood, that whole cult of the arena with gladiators and animals, very appealing to them. And for many Gauls, well, we'll just stop, you know, sacrificing people Druid style and go to the mass slaughter of humans and animals, which is supposed to have some kind of salutary advantage of telling everyone, don't oppose Rome, we are the great power. And so you see the development of arenas across Gaul in the 1st and 2nd century AD as one index of this change. The imperial cult, to which I had alluded, is another important feature brought in by the army. The Emperor Augustus established, cult is perhaps too strong a term, but we really don't have a word in English to gain the sense, that is, worshiping the genius, that is, the spirit of the Roman emperor, which would be deified upon his death when he joined the gods, that became a important religious and social institution attached to the Roman army. The Roman army swore oaths to the spirits of the imperial family, and this notion was exported to the provinces where major provincial shrines were set up, and the local aristocrats vied for holding the priesthood, for putting up temples to the imperial cult, that is, members of the imperial family, altars, probably getting a bit confused on the fact that they were worshiping the emperor rather than his spirit. There's always that problem with the provincials. But this is just another aspect of that impact of the Roman military presence. I mentioned that the Balkans and Dacia were similar to the patterns you saw in the Celtic West, in Britain and Gaul. It was also assisted that the Balkans and Dacia were the centers of important Roman mining activities. And those mining activities gave a special dimension to that area, and it really wasn't until the conquest of Dacia when these regions began to take off as Romanized provinces, these frontier zones. Gaul and Britain received the most imperial attention and military presence in the first century. It's only in the second century that the Balkans and the Dacia, that is the equivalent of modern Romania, conquered by Trajan, experienced this type of Romanization, and mining activities were extremely important in this. In Dalmatia, in regions which today would be modern Bosnia, there is an enormous gold rush in the reign of Nero. Miners moving in, exploiting these mines, and according to one report, by the death of Nero, something like 18,000 pounds of gold annually were being netted from the Dalmatian mines. That's well over 20 million denarii in value. The Dalmatian miners were so good that when the province of Dacia was set up after Trajan's conquest, they were brought in to exploit the mines in the Erzgebirge of the Carpathians, the gold mines that had traditionally fed the coffers of the Dacian kings. And we have a remarkable set of some 35 wax tablets from a region known as Alburnus Maior, which is Roșia Montană in Romania today. And what these record are contracts between Dalmatian miners brought in by the Roman imperial government to exploit the gold mines. And the contracts are extremely illuminating. The wages are very good by Roman standards. They're somewhere between 3 and 5 times above subsistence. Room and board is included, and I suspect there's an understanding, and this is based on studying mining arrangements in, say, colonial Spanish America or in Hungarian and German documents of the early modern age. There was probably an understanding that there was the official take for the government, and then anything you can steal was yours to keep, and there's always the unreported profits, which were probably quite substantial. The result were mining towns mushrooming across Dacia and in the Balkans, and these towns could be quite substantial. Again, by analogy of the Spanish-American situation, Potosi in Peru, you could end up with towns of 5,000 miners, some 10,000 laborers and slaves who were sorting the ore and doing all sorts of menial jobs, and then at least 15,000 to 20,000 that represented the people provisioning and providing all the entertainment and vices necessary in any mining town. And what happened is by 200 AD, you have a network of these mining towns, which are then in turn feeding the cities on the imperial highways with business. You know, those cities are exploiting the trade up to these mines, and they are in turn influencing the supporting of the agriculture in the supporting area, and the mining operations in Dacia and Dalmatia become significant ways of bringing in town life, a very rough provincial town life. To be sure, the Latin spoken in these towns had very little similarity to Virgil or Horace. Nonetheless, they profoundly transformed the traditional societies of these barbarian peoples. And it explains, for instance, the rapid Romanization of Dacia, the mining exploitation, the military presence, and the fact that Dacia resisted so powerfully and so many Dacians were killed and enslaved, so that Dacia, in its language, to this day, the Romanians claim a cultural link to the Roman experience, became a Latin-speaking region. Which is still an outpost of Latinity in Eastern Europe. This gets into a lot of nationalistic arguments about boundaries in Eastern Europe, but there is this cultural linguistic continuity that followed through the Middle Ages, and that is a result of the profound impact of Romanization in Dacia. Along the desert frontiers, the impact is perhaps not as remarkable. It's harder to detect because the Romans tended to station their forces well behind where the desert began, and much of the patrolling was done by Berber and Arab warrior groups. Nonetheless, these tribal groups would be organized into ethnic Roman auxiliary units. They would be stationed in Roman fortresses. One of the best examples of the remarkably mixed provincial culture that could emerge in these towns and these fortresses comes from Dura Europis, a site on the Euphrates that was excavated in the 1920s and 30s. Many of the objects are on display in the Yale Museum, the Yale Art History Museum. And it was the home of the 20th cohort of Palmyrenes, a Syrian group from that caravan city Palmyra, which was of the empire but not really in the empire. And again, we have an amazing record of this city for about 100 years under Roman control. It was sacked probably in 256 AD, so you have, in effect, a frozen record of that city. And what you have are these Syrian soldiers coming from a very tough zone. Their grandfathers were certainly Bedouin types, now in Roman military forces, learning a soldier's Latin in a very mixed town with Aramaic and Greek speakers. The city preserves a remarkable Jewish synagogue with a figural art. There's an earliest Christian house church there. It's a very mixed commercial center. A good deal of the commerce supporting this military unit, and perhaps one of the most remarkable documents that comes out of Dura Europis is the so-called military calendar, the Ferial Durianum, which is written in Latin and which all of these auxiliary soldiers were supposed to follow. And this is a calendar from the 220s AD, and the military calendar is celebrating traditionally Roman holidays to the gods of the army, Mars and Jupiter, as well as victories run by members of the imperial family going back to Augustus's day. And it's always amazing to me, these Syrians got a holiday with days off celebrating the victories of Germanicus in Germany back in 15 and 16 AD, 200 years earlier on a remote frontier none of these men would ever see. And yet that's part of their tradition, being soldiers and now being part of this great Roman structure. And it shows really the power of the Roman army in assimilating these people into the Roman system. Perhaps it's best to close with an example that I know from my own experience in working in the Roman world, because you can end up multiplying example after example on these frontier provinces. And this is in Asia Minor, an area that doesn't immediately leap to mind as a frontier zone. And the reason for that is Anatolia was a rather peculiar area. It had very urbanized Greek Hellenized regions. which have received a great deal of attention and study. But the interior and eastern sections of Asia Minor, which is today Turkey, was as much of a frontier province as anything you would encounter on the Rhine or the Danube. And to use a term in Chinese history, that is the inner barbarians, there were plenty of inner barbarians in Anatolia, tough mountain people in the Pisidian Highlands, the Isaurians, and the Pontic Alps, that had to be controlled militarily just as much as the Euphrates frontier against Armenians and Parthians. In southwestern Turkey today, in the Pisidian Highlands near the modern Turkish town of Yalvich, is a amazing Roman colony, Antiochia ad Pisidium. Antioch built near Pisidia, which is the district, a mountain district. It was founded by Augustus in 25 BC in a highland area, which is an alpine-style plain, which is still a very fertile farming area mixed with stock raising. And going to that region of today Yalvich and driving up there, the conditions are not too dissimilar to what these Roman legionaries, many of them in origin from the Apennines, from Umbria and Etruria, would have known at home. A Roman-style colony, perhaps 3,000, 4,000 veterans from two different legions along with their families were settled there. They built a Roman city in the middle of this rugged Anatolian landscape, typical of the types of colonies of discharged veterans that you find across the empire. This colony preserves one of our best examples of a veteran colony anywhere, because the Roman city was not subsequently occupied. It essentially disappeared in the 5th and 6th century AD, and the modern Turkish town is below it in the farming zone. So the city is up there intact, and only parts of it been excavated. But the way a traditional landscape can be transformed by settling veteran colonists is very well captured by this particular site. The colonists immediately set up the impressive public buildings with which they were familiar in Italy. And the architecture in this area of Anatolia, it doesn't show any Greek influences. It's just been brought over from Italy. There are a series of monumental stairways and squares leading to a great public center where the Temple of Augustus was built. And that temple was set against a three-story portico cut from the native stone there. And actually, the stone was used to build the temple, and they cleared out this area, so it acted as a dramatic backdrop to it. The res gestae divi Augusti was there. That is the great deeds of Augustus. The city had a theater that grew so large it had to be enlarged in the 4th century AD. They actually had to change the street pattern to accommodate the expansion of the theater. What was most impressive is this city had a series of walls cutting it off, defending it, typical Roman fortification walls with monumental gates, and to supply this city, an aqueduct was built, which still stands today, especially the arches as this aqueduct crosses the valley. And this aqueduct is carrying water from the surrounding mountains, which is somewhere between 4,700 and 5,200 feet above sea level, down to the city by a series of pumps, which is brought into the north end to supply the baths. Some 3,000 cubic meters of water per day were entering the city, supplying most of the city's need, and it spans over 6 miles in length, the whole system, from a series of springs up in the mountains. It is an absolutely spectacular example of how the Roman army and Roman military colonists could come in and transform an area, and recalls that notice I made earlier by Cassius Dio, that it's through buildings that Rome struck fear to her enemies and awe in her allies. The achievement is stunning. By 200 AD, the limes, the frontier, has come to mark a political and cultural boundary. It is not a Maginot line, but there is a distinction between what was once a Roman frontier zone and what are the barbarian lands on the other side. Furthermore, the provincial Romans by 200 AD, descended from the barbarian foes of Rome, are increasingly concerned about their security. And to some extent, that explains the vast expansion of the military system to defend these zones. They are now part of the Roman world, and they need to be defended. And that is already beginning in the reign of the Emperor Hadrian from 117 to 138 and would climax in the Severan Age, that is the dynasty ruling from 193 to 235. And it marks the beginning of that shift with which I spoke earlier of military, financial, and fiscal resources away from the Mediterranean core to those provinces. And increasingly, the imperial government in the Severan Age, and this is the dynasty founded by the Emperor Septimius Severus in 193-211. He was the product of a Roman provincial family in Africa, and his wife, an Empress Julia Domna, a really stunning woman who is from a Syrian Greek family. This is a totally provincial imperial family. The Severan dynasty, which ruled in Rome, appreciated the importance of the provinces, and they begin a very consistent policy of the imperial government cementing relations with those provincial elites and with the armies. They are still traditional Romans, but they now give recognition to the fact that the provinces, especially the frontier provinces, have become vital to Rome. And it is perhaps best to end this lecture with the legal affirmation of this fact in 212 AD when the Emperor Caracalla, the second of the Severan emperors, issued his so-called Constitutio Antoniniana, which extended citizenship to all free citizens of the Roman Empire. So now the Roman world was decidedly Roman as opposed to the barbarians who were outside that Roman world.